A growing number of Americans living along the coast in Louisiana, Florida, and Massachusetts are facing a painful decision. Do we leave now or wait until the next storm surge takes our home? I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. This is ClimateCast. Climate refugees, it's a term we hear more frequently now. What's the reality facing our newest climate refugees here in America? The Weather Channel is airing a series on the growing number of Americans who are moving away from higher seas. It's called Exodus. Here's how one resident of Scituate, Massachusetts, weighs her options.
I do worry about Scituate. Sadly, we're going to be leaving for the time being because the storms have just... They've been too much the past few years for us.
Weather.com's executive editor Kevin Hayes describes the situation.
So Scituate just got slammed this winter. They had back-to-back-to-back-to-back nor'easters that just clobbered the town. And residents are facing, you know, a future of records being broken again and again as sea level rises. And so people that live near the beach, people that have homes that are close to the ocean, which is why you want to live in Scituate, they're just the risk is increasing for them.
And I saw in the video, just incredible the amount of damage that was done during those nor'easters. Was that a wake-up call for some people there?
Yeah. When we spoke to a lot of people on the ground there, one person said, I'm moving. I'm done. I love this town. I love living here. But the moment when I looked out and could see the water being just roiled up by this storm was too much for me. So, for people, I don't think it's a town of, you know, climate deniers. I don't think it's a town that is unused to extreme weather. They said that as well. You know, we do this. We know this. But I think the severity this year got to some people.
And you talked with those people that are actually considering moving away, as you mentioned. How does that decision to move or stay play out for them?
I think it's really tough for them. You know, these were people who, if they weren't lifelong residents, they'd lived there for years and years. They don't want to leave. They have a life set up like anyone else does in a community that they've committed to. So, you know, the town isn't emptying out. But it's part of the math now, I think, for some people there. How long can we stay? At what point does it become too onerous to stick it out?
Scituate, you mentioned, sounds like a very weather-aware place, right? They're used to storms and severe weather. But did these storms, these particular set of nor'easters and the damage it caused, make that connection between climate change and extreme weather for some folks there?
Yeah, when we spoke to people, they very explicitly made the connection between climate change and those storms. We know sea level is rising. We know that these floods happened in part because of that. And so I was surprised a little bit by the, you know, eyes wide open aspect of climate change among residents in Scituate. It was not a town sticking its head in the sand by any means.
Kevin, the way you use people's own voices in telling their climate change stories, I thought was very powerful in the series. Scituate is one town. As you work on the series, are you hearing similar stories in other places?
Yeah. You know, it's playing out really differently in different places. You know, one of the stories we launched with was Jordan, and we talked about Syrian refugees and water scarcity in Azraq, Jordan. The people there are experiencing it very different than the people in Scituate, Massachusetts are experiencing climate change. The issues are different. The infrastructure is different. Everything is different. But in America and a lot of the places we're looking at stories and talking to people, we're seeing this, it's sort of the opening movements of people being worried. What does the future look like? If I have a, you know, 20 years on my mortgage, how many times am I going to flood? That kind of math seems to be becoming more prevalent.
Kevin, the project is called Exodus. What generated this idea?
So last year we worked on a series called United States of Climate Change. And just the idea of climate migration, the idea of people being pushed from one area to another for economic or weather-related reasons, it just kept coming up. It came up in our New York story, in our Arkansas story, and it just kept happening. And so this felt like a natural place to go and another place to examine climate change and the right lens to examine it through right now.
And it's amazing for many of us who watch and study climate science to see these changes happening so quickly and know that they're going to accelerate in the future. What other locations will you be profiling for the series? What's next?
We're going to return to the Middle East. We have a story coming out of Kurdistan. We are also looking at a refugee camp in Sicily, Lagos, Nigeria. We have a story we're planning for the fall from there. Some in Houston. We're trying to give a really diverse lineup of places and issues for the series.
Kevin Hayes is an executive editor at weather.com. Thanks for talking about your work today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Paul.
My name is Shaza Hussein. I'm 16 years old. I'm a rising senior at Rosemount High School, and I am involved in environmental activism and a variety of different initiatives to push the governor and state legislators to take action on climate change by regulating carbon and greenhouse gases. Youth in particular are often left out of the conversation. We saw just a few weeks ago when a politician called a girl young and naive, a girl that's close to my age. When it comes specifically to climate change, we don't have much say in the legislation, but we're the ones who are going to be burdened by the impacts. This past spring, me and a few other freshmen actually presented to the Rosemount Sustainability Task Force and the Rosemount Parks Commission to regulate carbon emissions by agreeing to the Paris Climate Accords and urging the federal government to do so also. So the Parks Commission is supportive of the topic and will likely recommend a resolution in August to City Council. My family does come from North Sudan. My grandfather, he just passed away, but he was a farmer. And over the years, he's noticed that farming in North Sudan has become increasingly difficult, especially because it already is so close to the Sahara Desert. But the intensification of weather and extreme heat has caused a lot of drought, and that's caused a lot of economic hardship for my family back home in Sudan. And then also just here in Minnesota, just seeing with the ice out dates and like people who enjoy fishing, things that are kind of near and dear to a lot of Minnesotans' hearts, kind of that being taken away from them or not to the degree that it was before. This is something that impacts everyone. And if we continue to let politicians be influenced by fossil fuel billionaires, that for youth in particular and for future generations is going to be devastating. So I feel like it's important that all people step up and really fight for a clean future and clean energy.
One of the biggest climate signals in Minnesota and northern states is warmer winters, and it's caused an explosion in the deer tick population. The tick swarms are producing what one Canadian scientist calls a vector-borne disease emergency. Elizabeth Schiffman is a senior epidemiologist in the Vector-Borne Diseases Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health.
You know, we know that climate change definitely has an effect on vector-borne diseases, but it's really hard to know kind of exactly what that impact is. Vector-borne diseases are so complex with all the environmental factors, climate factors, temperature variables, not to mention all the host factors and everything else. So it can be a really complicated thing to try to say, you know, one thing is affecting it more than anything else. But there's definitely changes happening.
I am not a fan of the creepy crawlers, so I very much respect what you do. What's a black-legged tick and why is it important?
Most people are probably familiar with them, but maybe think of them as deer ticks. That used to be their common name. So, and why people should really care about them is they're our main disease vector tick here in Minnesota. So they are capable of transmitting several different diseases to humans, and they are most active in kind of the late spring into the middle part of the summer. So we're sort of past tick-borne disease risk season in a lot of ways and are firmly into mosquito-borne risk season now, but both of them are big deals here in Minnesota.
What are the trends on the black-legged tick? Is it spreading? Has it spread into areas where it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago?
Definitely. We've definitely seen that spread generally kind of north and westerly in direction. So, you know, the kind of the traditional hotspot for black-legged ticks in Minnesota is kind of north-central Minnesota. And over the last 20 to 30 years, we've definitely seen them expand further west. west, further north, places like Itasca State Park, you didn't really used to find black-legged ticks. And now we go there every summer and sample ticks, and we always find things. So they're on the move for sure.
So where are they most common in Minnesota? Are there some places we need to be more vigilant than others when we're out and about? How do we protect ourselves?
Sure. So they're definitely found more frequently in kind of wooded and brushy parts of the state. So kind of the northern half of the state, northern two-thirds of it almost, are definitely more of a hot spot than I would say some of the southern parts, or especially the western and southwestern parts where we get into more of that prairie agricultural land. Mm-hmm. Black-legged ticks are, I always say, they're kind of princessy in the conditions they like. They don't like it to be too hot or too dry or too open, and so they really need that nice wooded, brushy habitat to be able to survive and persist.
I've talked to folks up in Cook County, Grand Marais area, who claim that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there really weren't many deer ticks up there. Is there any data to support that local information?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, there has been a bit of an expansion eastward as well into the Arrowhead. We didn't really used to see ticks, but definitely we've seen more expansion kind of western, in that western direction instead. But there definitely are ticks. One of my colleagues just found them up along the North Shore this summer for the first time on a trail that he's gone on many, many times over the years, and finally found some ticks this spring. So they are moving.
My dad used to say that our cold Minnesota winters keep the riffraff out. And yeah. By this, I think he meant ticks. You know, we hear about a magic number of 40 below zero for insect mortality in northern Minnesota, and the data is pretty clear we're not reaching that number as frequently now. What are the climate and temperature thresholds you look at that allow these ticks to spread?
So what we really look at more is kind of that overall trend. So if it's really cold and a dry winter where we don't have much snow cover, those are not favorable winters for ticks for sure. But if it's pretty cold, but we have a nice layer of snow that kind of insulates things. So at the ground level, it's keeping the temperatures, as you're aware, you know, fairly close to freezing. And so if there's snow cover to insulate them, they do just fine.
So it'd be nice to get a week or two with little snow and a lot of cold.
And a lot of cold, and it can help knock them out. There always seem to be some that manage to survive, but yeah.
Why is the spread of infectious disease so sensitive to even what seem like these small shifts in climate that we're seeing in Minnesota?
I think part of it is just that there are so many factors at play. So you can change one element and it can have impacts, you know, further down the line. So you can have changes in temperature or precipitation, for example, and that can impact host species or vegetation or all those things. And then if you kind of compound things together, you start to see changes, and impacts from changes in human activity as well are also at play. So if the weather is maybe favorable for vector species, but it's not weather that humans want to be out and about in, you know, you're probably not going to have as many interactions.
This is happening in Minnesota. It's happening in New England. It's happening in Canada. A quote I saw from Dr. Nicholas Ogden, a senior scientist at Canada's Public Health Agency, says, quote, a vector-borne disease emergency. That's what he's calling it. Is it that serious?
I think it has gotten more serious, you know, in recent years. There are lots of, you know, we're definitely seeing increases in human case numbers. We're finding ticks in places that we haven't seen them before. And with some of the advances in diagnostics, it's easier for us to find new pathogens. So that's one thing that we're always finding, with collaborators in other states, at Mayo Reference Lab, other partners, you know, who have a bit more testing capacity, but we're always finding new pathogens. And so it just continues to broaden the scope of things to be concerned about or things that we care about more.
And what's being done here in Minnesota?
So here in Minnesota, our primary focus at the health department is kind of looking at these changes and tracking them over time. So we do a lot with human case surveillance. So these diseases are reportable to us. So it's our job to follow up, learn more kind of about people's exposures, what kind of symptoms they had, that kind of thing. And then we also have a pretty substantial field component to our work, where we go out every season, every spring and summer, and sample for ticks and look at, you know, how many ticks we can find in locations that we visit year to year. We test those ticks to see, you know, what they're carrying and kind of those infection prevalence numbers in ticks. So that's kind of what we're doing, is tracking those changes over time.
And are we talking about Lyme disease? Is that the big one?
Lyme disease is definitely our biggest tick-borne disease, but we also always want people to know it's not just Lyme disease anymore. So kind of our next big ones are anaplasmosis, another disease transmitted by that same black-legged tick, and then babesiosis, as well as a host of other less common pathogens as well.
So Elizabeth, is it just this one species of deer tick, or are there other ticks and other insects that are causing diseases to spread?
Sure, that's a great question. We definitely have more different kinds of species of ticks here in Minnesota. The black-legged tick is definitely the one we think about as being the most concerning for human disease transmission. But the American dog tick, or what most of us think of as the wood tick, those are also really common. And there is a chance that they could also, there are a few pathogens, I should say, that they can also spread, but they're not kind of our primary tick vector. And then on the mosquito side, you know, we definitely have mosquito-borne diseases as well. Things like West Nile virus is definitely our most common, lacrosse encephalitis. And right now, this latter half of the summer into the early part of fall is really prime risk season for mosquito-borne diseases. So it's not just ticks.
Elizabeth Schiffman, Senior Epidemiologist in the Vector-Borne Diseases Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thanks for talking about your work today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally this week, bright spots in the clean energy economy. A new report shows there are nearly 60,000 clean energy jobs in Minnesota now. The Clean Jobs Midwest report expects growth in clean energy jobs in the Midwest to continue at 4.5% this year. The biggest gains are in energy efficiency, renewables, and smart grid technology. That's ClimateCast this week. With thanks to Climate Generation, I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.